Okay, let's get started. Welcome everyone to the Thursday night plenary session of the 2009 Sunstone Salt Lake Symposium. My name is Matt Thurston. I'm a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors, and I'll be chairing this session. Before I introduce the session and our panel here, let's begin with an opening song that will be Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. Our Dan Watts and Alan Eastman will do the honors of directing and accompanying us on the piano. Following the opening song, we'll have an opening invocation by Morris Thurston.
Pacific Ocean. Second verse again. Everybody in unison, please. Come on.
Take the message that they wish to convey. We ask thee to bless all of those who are in authority in any branch of thy church, that they will understand the responsibilities that come with it and seek thy guidance at all times. And we ask for these blessings in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you, our Dean Allen and Morris, for a great beginning to this evening. Before we get in with the program, a couple of matters of business to discuss. First, I'd like to remind everyone to please stop by the Sunstone Giving Tree in the lobby, just directly behind us. There are a variety of ornaments you can buy, such as printer toner, phone service, a security alarm, monitoring fees. Take your selection to the registration desk for purchase, then pin your ornament on the tree and pin a sunbeam button on yourself to wear proudly. Remember, your donations to Sunstone are all fully tax deductible, and donations given between now and the 31st of August will be matched dollar for dollar. You can double the impact of your gift no matter what the amount. Second, anyone making a donation up to $4,000 or more, your gift will also get you a free year supply of gelato from Dolcetti Gelato and Sugar House. So I just purchased a small the other day, and it was like $4. That's quite a gift. This is, comes courtesy of Mark England. And then third, be sure to visit the book room while you're here. A percentage of your purchase will from Benchmark Books will also support Sunstone. So this is session 191, The Dynamics of Power and Authority in the LDS Church. I'm excited to be chairing this session. First, the topic, Power and Authority in the LDS Church, is arguably the key or foundational or all pervasive subject that undergirds nearly every session topic appearing in this year's Sunstone Symposium. Second, the Sunstone organizers have done a great job of assembling this panel with a real murderer's row of great speakers representing diverse experience and unique points of view related to power and authority in the LDS Church. Let me briefly introduce them, and they will speak in the order that you see in their program. First up is Jana Reese. She has degrees in religion from Wellesley College and Princeton Theological Seminary, and a PhD in American Religious History from Columbia University. She's the former religion book review editor of Publishers Weekly. Now she's the acquisitions editor of Westminster John Knox Press, and she's the author or co-author of 6 books, including Mormonism for Dummies and What Would Buffy Do? Also, she has a great personal blog. If you're into books, you've got to check that out. What's the address?
Thank you. It's janareese.typepad.com. Thank you.
janareese.typepad.com. Just great ideas for great books that are out there. Next, we have Darius Gray. Darius is a former television journalist who served for more than 20 years in the presidency of the Genesis Group, the church's official support organization for Black Latter-day Saints. He's the co-director and co-producer with Margaret Young of Nobody Knows, The Untold Story of Black Mormons. He is the owner and president of Tesla Corporation, a dealer in high-performance automobile parts. Third up, we have Dale Luffman, who has been an apostle of the Community of Christ since 1994, currently assigned to the West Central USA mission field. He holds a Doctor of Ministry degree from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary and a Master's of Theology degree from Princeton Theology Seminary. And then we have D. Michael Quinn. Michael Quinn defined himself as a homosexual at age 12, but decided to avoid sex with Studleys and live the hetero life expected by family, friends, and society in the LDS Church. Now the divorced father of 4 children, a continued friend of his remarried ex-wife, a Vietnam-era veteran of the U.S. Army, a Yale PhD, a former professor of American history for 12 years at BYU, and an excommunicated Mormon, he has published Same-Sex Dynamics Among 19th Century Americans, a Mormon Example, which received the Best Book Award from the American Historical Association. Also, Prelude to the National Defense of Marriage Campaign from Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, fall 2000. And the preface for William D. Russell's Homosexual Saints, The Community of Christ Experience. An independent scholar, Quinn's most recent academic appointment was as postdoctoral associate in Yale's Department of History in 2002 and 2003. And then finally, bringing up the rear, we've got Michael J. Stevens, holds a PhD in organizational psychology, is associate professor at Weber State University, and co-chair of the Sensegen Board of Directors. So we turn our time over to Jan.
I'm trying not to interpret the dimming of the lights as a theological judgment on what I'm about to say. I seem to spend a lot of time at airports. One day, as I was waiting for my suitcase to arrive on the luggage carousel, I got to thinking about this whole crazy airline system that manages millions of pieces of luggage every day with surprising effectiveness. But if I were a stranger to this system, looking at it from the outside, with no prior experience of how it worked, I would declare it certifiably insane. Why? Anyone could come up to the carousel at any time and grab the first suitcase that appealed to them. It's not like anyone actually checks those little bag claims that you get to see if the one you were taking is the same one that you surrendered earlier in the day, and not just the one that appealed to you in the heat of the moment because it was designed by an Italian and is real leather, while yours was manufactured at Target. Any fellow passenger on your flight could filch your bag, or for that matter, any person from the community who is reasonably well-dressed and affecting a certain worldly or weary demeanor could just take a day trip out to the airport, quietly make off with any bag that looks like it might be worth something. The whole system is ripe for abuse. What's astonishing, though, is that luggage theft doesn't happen very often. In all my years of flying, I've never had a bag stolen. Now, I have endured several occasions where my luggage has been temporarily lost or delayed. I've stood across the baggage counter from airline agents who clearly couldn't care less about my suitcase, or who seemed woefully undertrained for their positions, or who were just plain worn out from being overworked and in a thankless job. But I've never been the victim of luggage theft or intentional abuse. I think you probably see where I'm going with this. While I stood at the carousel reflecting on this, it occurred to me that the situation with my bag was roughly parallel to my experience of priesthood authority in the LDS Church. Before I joined the LDS Church at the age of 23, I stood on the outside, looking in on a system that seemed ripe with the potential for abuse. Denying leadership opportunities to more than one half of the adult membership of any organization, prima facie, without regard to merit or talent, is never a recipe for equality. So the deck is stacked from the very beginning. I can understand perfectly when my non-Mormon friends who are journalists or academics give me that look when we talk about what it feels like to be a 21st century Mormon woman, what it feels like to inhabit a Latter-day skin. You might know that look. It's an indulgent one, because you're talking to people who love you and who respect your opinion in all other matters, save this one in which you are clearly insane. So I do work and live in a system that routinely denies me a say. My voice is never heard in important meetings. Many church callings are entirely closed to me. Decisions are made that have direct bearing on my life and spirituality that are simply announced to me later, ex post facto. And the sexism that exists in church policy tends to trickle down in more subtle areas, like the BYU-sponsored academic groups and gatherings that sort of, kind of, forget to invite any women scholars. It would be hard for any reasonable person to conclude that women are more than second-class citizens in the LDS power structure. And yet, although I chafe under many of the restrictions of this system, I don't feel oppressed. I just want to say that one more time. I do not feel oppressed. I chose to be here. I choose every day to remain here. And I have never been the victim of ecclesiastical abuse. On the contrary, I've had almost entirely positive experiences with priesthood leaders, including two deeply kind and wonderful bishops who have counseled me, who have challenged me with difficult callings, and extended love to my non-LDS family. Now, I hope that the people in the audience who have experienced ecclesiastical abuse will understand that I'm only speaking from personal life, and not making any broad statements that I don't believe such abuse ever happens. It does. But I haven't encountered it myself. And by the way, this is as good a time as any to note the impossibility of standing up here and speaking for all women. I can't speak for all women, and I'm not going to try. I'm just glad to have the opportunity to lay out before you my own thoughts and experiences. So for the remaining few minutes, I'd like to highlight three reasons why I can remain a faithful and active member of the church, even while being aware of the great cognitive dissonance of my luggage. Reason number one, because the raft is not the shore. One reason I can stay in the church so happily is that I'm able to keep the church's own importance in perspective, at least most of the time. In part, this is because I didn't grow up Mormon, which has turned out to be a tremendous blessing in my Mormon life. That actually wasn't intended to be a joke. I don't have to reckon with a lot of the cultural baggage that I think many birthright Mormons do, and I certainly don't have the difficult encounters that many of you might have at family reunions. I think that I agree with Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh when he famously wrote that the raft is not the shore. What he meant for organized religion is that it is a means to an end and not the end itself. For Mormons, the church is our best vehicle to encounter Christ and understand our role in God's plan. I believe that. It is, however, neither immortal nor infallible. And when we cling to it too tenaciously, like the traveler on the raft, we may actually risk never quite arriving at our intended destination. I think that many Mormons do believe that the raft is the shore itself, the final destination, the unchanging safe haven. The church has become the drive-through window through which their Mormonism is tidily dispensed. What's particularly sad about this to me, however, is that many liberal Mormons also buy this idea, hook, line, and sinker, imagining that the church as an institution is the sole mediator of the Mormon experience. When they have problems with the church, they then have issues with all of Mormonism, because they believe somewhere deep down that the raft is the shore. Part of my success in staying active in the church rests with my sensitivity to its best place in my life. It is a vehicle for growing spiritually and for doing good, which I'll get to in a minute. But it is not for me the end all. I tend to negotiate my level of activity. I once took a sabbatical from church, an entire year, in which I read and reflected intentionally about Mormonism, but did not attend church or hold a calling. This carved-out breathing space did exactly what sabbaticals are supposed to do. It gave a person facing burnout and resentment a chance to step back, to get in touch with creativity, and remind herself about the most important things. That sabbatical has fueled nearly a decade of active participation in the church since I came back in August of 2001. If I need to, I will do it again. With the understanding that the raft is not the shore, and with the knowledge that it's up to me to realize who I am in Christ, in the spirit of inane Facebook quizzes everywhere, I made a quiz for myself. I devised my own two-part quiz about Mormon identity, and maybe I'll post that someday on my blog, which you very kindly mentioned. The first part is about where a person stands doctrinally. How does she feel about the Savior, the resurrection, the restoration, the Book of Mormon, and Joseph Smith as a prophet? The second part is about practice. Where does she stand in terms of daily prayer, family home evening, regular scripture study, word of wisdom adherence, tithing, and the like? I'll spare you the details of the actual quiz, which is still in progress, but suffice it to say that in my own quiz, I came out around 90% Orthodox and 80% orthopractic. By my admittedly lax academic standards, that's an A- and a B- respectively. I fell down on orthopraxy because I skip conference too often, don't have family home evening, a failing I attribute to the fact that the rest of my family is Episcopalian, and that I despise green jello. So if you average that, you're looking at a B-grade Mormon, someone who's probably not destined for the celestial heights of a heavenly Harvard or Yale, but for the more humble, terrestrial destinations, the spiritual equivalent of a Carlton or a Grinnell. The thing is, though, I don't really worry about this that much. I am moving forward on my raft with my Mormon spiritual growth, and I don't compare myself to the super saints. I have too much work to do, which brings me to my second point. Reason number two, because the need for Christians is so great. Another reason I'm not currently deeply exercised about questions of power, which may change at any moment, I just want to reserve that right, is that I'm trying too hard to be the hands and feet of Jesus, who eschewed such questions in favor of ministry. But I want to choose my words really carefully here, because I've always hated it when Mormon women say things like, oh, I would never want the priesthood. I've got too much to do. The priesthood is so much responsibility. That's not what I'm saying. I feel, actually, that such a statement is profoundly un-Mormon. Nowhere in the gospel do I find that our people, male and female, are ever expected to give less than our best, to resist rolling up our sleeves to be of service. Maybe these women don't realize that such an unchristlike rejection of service is the theological implication of that statement, but it is. And that's wrong. Because the fact is that the heart of the priesthood is service. In fact, in Mormonism, entry-level service is defined by the role of the deacon, and diakonos is the Greek word for servant. Priesthood holders are, at their foundation, the servants of Christ and of this people. What I mean when I talk about being busy in service is that even without the priesthood, there is no end to the service I can do. And I love to imagine how the church might change if we, and when I say the church, I mean we, the people, began envisioning it as less of a country club and more of a hospital. This week, for example, I returned home from our family vacation in time to go to church on Sunday, but I chose not to go, since I'd already made arrangements for not being there, and we had to drive our daughter to her grandparents on Sunday afternoon. But on Sunday night, one of the women I visit teach was admitted to the hospital. And so I spent most of the evening and much of the next 2 days by her side. That is church, too, the community that Mormons have such a genius for creating. Since I'm currently a counselor in the Relief Society presidency, I attend welfare meetings, and I'm growing more and more aware of the great needs within our small urban ward in Cincinnati. Just this year, the Relief Society president tells me, we've gone from having 3 families on church welfare to 7, and that's not including several others that probably ought to be receiving help, but have been too proud to ask. All of that, of course, is just a drop in the bucket compared to the enormous needs of the poor who don't have the social safety net of the church. The poor in my city, the poor in other nations. There's no end to the needs. So the enormity of the task helps me to keep my focus. Yes, it's sometimes hard to be a member of a church that gives me no administrative authority. But that is such a selfish concern when compared to the tremendous work we have to do. I feel that Christ is calling me not just to be a feminist, but to be a feminist liberationist, not only preoccupied with my own self-advancement, or the advancement of mostly white, middle-class Mormon women who are privileged enough to live in this region of the world, but all people and all issues everywhere. Reason number 3, because the priesthood will come. The final reason I don't get tremendously exercised about LDS women and power is because I am trained as a historian. It's because I know that whatever our situation is right now, 100 or at most 200 years from now, LDS women will have the priesthood and will have full equality in this church. It may even occur sooner. This summer, I've had the privilege in my day job of editing a book of essays by a mid-century female theologian named Georgia Harkness. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of Georgia Harkness. 2 people. Okay. I inherited this project from another editor, so it wasn't something I acquired myself, and my first thought was, who the heck is Georgia Harkness? What I found out about her was very surprising. Harkness was one of the most important theologians of the 1930s through the 1950s. She was friends and hung out with Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr. She wrote prolifically. She raised up a whole generation of theological students and changed the course of Protestant theology in this country. And yet, I had never heard of her. Even though I had a master's degree from a Protestant seminary, a doctoral degree from a university specializing in women and religious history, and I did not know this woman's name. And the reason, essentially, is sexism, plain and simple. There are 2 ways to look at her story. One is to decry the sexism and bemoan the loss of Harkness's voice for more than half a century. The other is to marvel at how very quickly things can change. We can't hazard any intelligent guesses about when Mormon women will have the priesthood. but I can at least paint the picture of what must be happening in Mormonism at that time. The answer is found in the 2002 movie, Whale Rider. Some of you may have seen this beautiful New Zealand film about Pai, a 12-year-old girl, and her determination to preserve the dying heritage of her people. Although her grandfather insists that Pai cannot inherit the mantle of leadership because she is female, and the position of the tribal chief has always descended in their family from eldest son to eldest son, Pai persists in learning and carrying out all of the traditions of her tribe, from traditional fighting methods to learning oral legends. Her grandfather ignores the leadership potential right under his nose and goes to all of the young men in their small community, but none of them is equal to the task of spiritual leadership. In the final scene, when the tribe's special whales wash up on the beach, signaling the end of the community and its special traditions of being the people of the whales, it is Pai who dares to ride a whale's back and coax it and its fellows back into the ocean to safety. Finally, her grandfather realizes that the future of their people rests not with his son, but with his son's daughter, who is filled with courage, wisdom, and light. That film made me cry, not only because it was beautifully acted and filmed, but because it hit upon a poignant truth in religious movements. Women get the priesthood only when men don't value it anymore. And when a tradition seems endangered, numerically or spiritually, that's depressing, but is generally true, as seen in the histories of some other religious groups in America, including many Protestant denominations, some of the more liberal Jewish traditions, and even the grassroots movement, so far unsuccessful, to allow Catholic women to be ordained as deaconesses. What becomes clear is that religious movements begin to open up to female leadership only when they perceive that the old ways just aren't working anymore. They're losing members, or money, or influence, or all three. Now, while I'm aware that there is a strong theological tradition in Mormonism that declares that this kind of decline will never occur in the LDS Church, I just don't find that kind of exceptionalism very historically realistic or biblically based. I'm not saying that the Church will disappear, far from it, but it's not likely to sustain the wild growth it has experienced in the last half century. There will be increased problems of attrition, of cultural relevance, of limited resources. Some of these problems we're already seeing in different parts of the world. But the key thing for me as a Latter-day Saint and a woman is that when those kinds of reevaluation happen in religion, the door is open to new ways of thinking, and women will be there, ready to serve. It may not be me, but it may be your descendants. We are just blips on the radar of the Mormon trajectory, but for now, for me, it is enough. Thank you.
As of right now, everyone is Southern Baptist. Good evening, brothers and sisters.
Good evening.
Thank you. I needed that, and I'll tell you why. I finally figured it out. I have done presentations in something like 37 of the 50 states, and have traveled widely and spoken before more audiences than I can count, and I can't remember the last time I was nervous, until now. And so many of you are my friends. I know you. I appreciate you. I know your support is there, and I'm grateful for it. And so I had to ask, what's wrong? Why are you nervous? And it finally came to me. It has been so long since I have read a paper. And I think these trifocals are going to be the death of me. So bear with me on that. And number two, I'm going to be discussing some things that I've not talked about in public before, as I'll state in the paper. And I'm a bit sensitive to it. And I'm afraid it might come across as being heavy and sort of down. And I want you to know, and I think most of you who know me know, that I am a happy, proud Latter-day Saint. I joined this church in 1964. I'm in my 44th year and on my way to my 45th anniversary. I am grateful for my membership. Now, that is my disclaimer. Oh, these trifocals are fun. A reading of the abstract advertising this panel refers to me as a black man who first experienced exclusion from exercising power and inclusion after the 1978 revelation on blacks in the priesthood. The two topics are joined at the hip, but are more different than the abstract might imagine. What did it mean to be excluded from that divine priesthood? Looking back to the days before June 8, 1978, it should be understood that the priesthood restriction was more than not being ordained. That one instrument, that one act of exclusion, spoke an encyclopedia's worth of thou shalt nots and thou art not. Over the years, a few well-intentioned saints have attempted to explain or soften the priesthood restriction, saying it is similar to the situation in the Old Testament, wherein one group, the Levites, officiated in the Aaronic priesthood, while in today's church, the LDS church, oh, that will help, thank you. However, it is often missed that, in the biblical example, only one group held the priesthood, while in the LDS application, only one group was excluded from the priesthood. The two situations are exactly opposite. No matter how it is approached, there isn't a correlation. For blacks in the church prior to the 1978 revelation, the lack of ordination, which was available to most young boys at the age of 12, separated blacks into, as Elder Bruce R. McConkie would put it, a caste apart. We were told that we had sinned against God, and as a result, we were cursed by God. That view placed an impenetrable wall between the majority of God's family within the church and the one group which was left behind, the Negro, or blacks. Two personal examples hopefully will bring focus to the consequences of that former policy. During my 44 plus years as a Latter-day Saint, I have never spoken publicly of these matters, and I ask your indulgence. In 1967, while living in Salt Lake City and working as a journalist for KSL Radio and Television, I met and fell in love with a lovely LDS woman. She was white. Prior to meeting her, I had dated a number of black women, but each of them found it difficult to see any future with a black Mormon who would not give up his chosen faith. Kathy, the white woman, loved me as I was. In 1968, a date was set for our wedding. Because of the priesthood restriction, that marriage could not take place in a temple. We called upon a friend who happened to be a bishop, asking him to perform the civil ceremony at an LDS chapel. That good man took the matter to his state president, who took it further to N. Eldon Tanner, second counselor in the first presidency of President David O. McKay. The fate of two young Latter-day Saints now became a point of consideration in the highest councils of the church. After not hearing back from President Tanner, the state president followed up and was told that permission was granted, but the church would not put it in writing. Only this year, I have learned the backstory which resulted from our hoped-for marriage. The journal President David O. McKay, dated Wednesday, 26th of June, 1968. President Alvin R. Dyer had been named as a counselor to President McKay only 2 months before. As the note said in the journal of President McKay, no meeting of the first presidency was held this morning. The only meeting that the president had was with Elder President Dyer. The topic? Negroes. It had been a topic that was in the president's journal for some days, and today it was also on the agenda. Because approval had been given to a Negro employed at KSL to marry a white girl, a student at BYU. It was also reported to me, said the journal, that the president, President Hugh B. Brown, had received a visit from Darius Arden, it's Aiden, A-I-D-A-N, Gray, G-R-A-Y, a Negro employed by KSL, who asked President Brown's advice regarding his marrying a white girl. Now, imagine just two young people in love winding up on the agenda of the president of the church and you're not knowing it until years later. She was a student at the Brigham Young University. Her name is Catherine Farmer, an orphan from Idaho. Prior to keeping company with this girl, Mr. Gray had been going with a colored girl. Arch Madsen of KSL confirmed the report that Darius Gray, a member of the church, did ask President Brown about the matter, and that it was reported by Gray that President Brown had said, I would rather have you married in the church than out of the church, thereby giving his approval of the marriage. Arrangements were made for Dr. Quinn McKay, a professor at Weber College, to perform their marriage. Now, at this point, that's not too bad. You know, it's a little unusual to think that you would be on the agenda of the president of the church, but that's not too bad. If it had stopped at that point, it wouldn't be as hurtful as it later turned out to be. Brother Madsen said that he had attended the wedding ceremony. Now, I don't know how many of you remember Arch L. Madsen, president of Bonneville International and KSL. He was my boss. He had hired me. He had asked me to come to work at KSL in 1967. He was a dear friend and a mentor, and I'm very grateful for him. And I have full confidence in his support of me because he exhibited that support over the years. However, as Elder Dyer went on to say, it was also reported that Darius Gray is not as loyal to the church as some think. One of the employees at KSL reported that he profanes at the office. Well, I've been practicing for the J. Golden Kimball chair. He was not liked by some of the employees for his actions at KSL. Now, how would you like this being told, the president of the church, about you? A remark was made to him that in his attending and talking at various church meetings, he was helping the church, and he answered, "Don't worry, I'm using the church." Well, I have never used the church, and I would hope that 44 years of service would indicate my loyalty to this church. And to find that and to read that is an indicator of what it was like prior to June 8th, 1968. 1978. For those of us who were members of the church and black, we had no support. We were on our own. And that loneliness is hard to explain. Here I have being a part of the family. I'm a better part of the family now than I was a few days ago. Some of you may know that I'm an amateur genealogist. And so often in this church, it's about not only what you know, but who you know and who your family connections are. And again, as a lone black in the church, it can be kind of unfortunate. Well, doing my research, I found my great-great-grandmother, the little-known wife of Brigham Young. I think there's quite a likeness, don't you?
The hair.
Yeah, it's the hair.
The hair.
Actually, that's not the case, but I thought it was.
It's already on the internet.
She was the cook. And they don't talk about her much. But Brigham quite liked her, actually. I'll give you a second example of what it was like prior to 1978. Kathy and I were married by Bishop McKay. We attended a married student's ward at the University of Utah. One particular Sunday stands out in my mind. As the sacrament was being passed, I partook and then reached to take the handle of the bread tray. At that point, the young priesthood holder quickly withdrew the tray from my grasp and reached around to offer the sacred bread to my white wife. In that moment, the completeness of my restriction became painfully clear. In that man's eyes, and likely in the eyes of many of his generation, I wasn't even worthy to extend the sacrament to another of God's children. Now to touch briefly on post-78 realities. I am blessed to bear the Melchizedek priesthood. Just last Sunday, I officiated in two priesthood ordinances, and the only notice given my inclusion was deference for an old man. It has been my pleasure to oversee a unit of the church, the Genesis group, and to perform marriages for couples, regardless of race and ethnicity. God is good, and times do change. Amen. Now I want to touch on the topic of institutional power. I have none. It's as simple as that. There are friends here tonight who would argue that I am more powerful than imagined, but in truth, I have very little power. Any office holder in the church serves at the pleasure of his or her local authority, or at the pleasure of the general authorities of the church, and that is as it should be. However, the power base for some is different. An article I read and saved decades ago pointed out the distinction between being a VIP and a celebrity. A VIP has a power base. They are not as dependent as some for validation. They are the captains of industry, the movers, the shakers, and those whose power is understood. I have none of that. If anything, I am a bit of a curiosity due to a long-established stubbornness and support for this gospel of Jesus Christ. And if that is my only claim to fame, I'll gladly embrace that accusation. That said, I realize what real power is, and there is real power in the hallowed halls of this church. I became the beneficiary of real power just days following my birth. My parents, Darris and Elsie Gray, were black, poorly educated, and citizens at a time in this country when no black person had any power. My birth took place in Colorado Springs, Colorado, at Glockner Penrose Hospital. in December of some long forgotten year. Obama and I have something in common there. When my father called to see how my release from the hospital had gone, his inquiry was met by my mother's tears. "They won't release my baby," she cried. The bill hadn't been paid. The total bill for my birth came to less than $10. Dad went to his employer, Merrill Shoup. Now, Mr. Shoup had real power. He was CEO and chairman of the board of the Holly Sugar Company. He was the son of the former Colorado governor and a board member of the Glockner Penrose Hospital. It took one call from Mr. Shoup for Elsie's baby to be released. The old established pioneer families within the church have that same sense and type of power as exercised by Mr. Shoup. There are connections and names that frequently repeat, histories that support access. But for latecomers to the faith, especially those who might look a bit different, the future might best be thought of in the words of Blanche DuBois in the Tennessee Williams play, A Streetcar Named Desire. Miss DuBois' final words as she was being led away by the doctor to the mental institution were, "Whoever you are, I have always depended on the kindness of strangers. And so it is with me. I have depended upon the kindness of strangers, and I thank you for your kindness."
Couldn't resist the image of the raft. I think I represent a community that was on another raft. Might be a very good way of picturing some things. I come here not only as a general officer of the Community of Christ, but I guess that's a little different way of saying, you would say, a general authority. The difference of a raft. But I also come as a trained theologian. And as a theologian, think about questions like power and authority, perhaps in a little different way than an ecclesiastical bureaucrat. One of the ways that I would like to begin to approach our consideration tonight is to reflect on a volume, just briefly, a volume written, one of my favorite writings of Karl Barth. It is a volume that's rarely read. Well, I doubt if many here have read volumes of Karl Barth, but maybe a colleague at Princeton at one time may have. But that volume is the volume called 19th Century Protestant Theology. Karl Barth writes probably one of the best one-volume commentaries on European Protestant theology that is currently in print over these years. The amazing thing about this volume is that while he writes about the 19th century, he spent the first third of that volume talking about the 18th century and saying, basically, you don't know what the issues for the 19th century are unless you know the questions and issues of the 18th. I would like to suggest to you that the LDS community, both rafts and others, are an inheritor of issues implicit in the 18th century and early 19th century, and they have encoded our experience far more significantly than most of us ever will realize. And that it is especially important that as inheritors of the 18th and early 19th century context, and as seekers in that late 18th and early 19th century, and as persons who are associated, whether we recognize it or not, with the great flow of what was called Christian primitivism that we share with such movements as the Stone Campbell movement that are representative of the Christian churches of various ilks, that authority was to be invested critically in the New Testament and in that New Testament's framing or creating the paradigm for understanding the gospel, probably bequeathed to us most significantly by one called Sidney Rigdon, whose language became a part of the language of the church in the Kirtland era of the church, in which we said something about the authority of the church invested in the restoration of the ancient order of things. You see, that arises out of the North American context and conversation amongst those who would seek to understand their faith and found it emerging. I would like to suggest to you that the community of Christ represents, in a sense, a tapping of that early Christian primitivist experience in some profoundly significant ways. There is implicit in the community of Christ's understanding of its beginnings that there is significance to be found in the shaping of that understanding through an amazing document that finds itself coming into being in the early 19th century, which we attest to as the Book of Mormon. In it, one can see Joseph Smith's working out the early understandings of authority. There are implicits in the very nature of the volume's narrative, how authority is to be understood. And if you trace that with the Mosiah priority, you find a growing understanding of Joseph's own understanding in the development of the text. Authority is very important because it is in that text that at the same time of its composition, the earliest texts of the Doctrine and Covenants emerge. And as they emerge, understandings about this movement begin to take embryonic shape. And the authority of the church is embedded in those very early documents. I've said to a lot of people who are not sure about the Book of Mormon, to say, the DNA of the church is implicit in that document. You can't talk about the church without talking about the Book of Mormon. I'd like to suggest to you that not only the Book of Mormon, but I'd like to suggest the elect lady has something to do with the reorganization. We heard something in one of the groups about her ordination. And for the community of Christ on this particular raft, Emma plays a very significant role. You see, Emma and others who came into the church in the early time as seekers found in the Book of Mormon and found in their culture the world address, their world address, I guess. Somebody didn't like what I said. They found their world addressed by the witness that the Book of Mormon held. And I would dare suggest that the earliest converts to the church, the Whitmers, the Cowdries, the various families that were attracted to the witness, were attracted because of the Book of Mormon message. And it was those people who were first attracted, many of which were no longer a part of the church after the Far West period, and who later found their way into the reorganization or followed James J. Strang for a little while and then found their way into the reorganization, were captured by that earlier vision articulated in that authority that they found in that work. The later converts to the church, particularly from Great Britain, who were converted by the 12, found their way west. Many of the earlier converts did not. And I would suggest to you that implicit in those early years are the nature of the difference of the way in which the community of Christ and the church in Utah have understandings of themselves in our present world. The community of Christ continued to live and continues to live in the awkward tension of those beginnings that are to be found in those kinds of moments of the early 19th century. We're still answering some of those questions. It is not the past that is inerrant, but our history calls us to think our faith and confess our faith in an inexhaustible and mysterious journey that it has informed us that we are called to an openness to revelation in and through a community that has been formed in a unique and significant way in North America in the early 19th century. In some ways, Section 156, which came to the Community of Christ, then known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, authorizing women in priesthood, is an example of all of this tension. It was not an easy decision, but it arose out of the very nature of what the church, in its reading of authority, had come to be. Because, you see, the question of who exercises authority has been at the heart of our movement. And if you were to read our history, I'm still trying to get Bill Russell to do that. If you would read our history, he's just making it up, actually. If you read our history has been fraught with debate and critical conversation and heated dialogue. That is permitted in the community of Christ. It is actually expected. If you were to come to one of our world conferences, as we have sometimes had guests from the West, and sit in on it, sometimes they are aghast. They are aghast, at least amazed, at the debate and conferring that occurs and the way in which we honor one another and yet are willing and practiced in confronting one another. We have become, over the years, in the nature of how we have come to understand our wrath, to not just simply be a people with a prophet, but with us understanding beginning in the days of Nauvoo and its aftermath, we were those that I guess in more conservative evangelical circles would have been called the left behind people. We were those who took some very important clues from Emma. And Emma's significant influence on her son, Joseph Smith III. And if I were to say who is the founder of the Community of Christ, this is a personal opinion, please don't hold it as a general officer's statement. It would be that the Community of Christ's founder is Joseph Smith III with the elect lady in the shadows. Our raft took those directions, somewhat of a rejection of the kind of authority that we saw practiced on another raft. And increasingly, even though Joseph Smith III presided over the church for more than a half a millennia, oh no, not a millennia, half a century, it seemed like a millennia. But over a half a century, in fact, Joseph Smith III's personality is stamped all over the Community of Christ. He is for us our very spatial framer of the way we understand all that came before and how that authority begins to be practiced among us. In fact, his own personality suggests our practice, because we've moved from being a people with a prophet to a prophetic people who happen to have a prophet. And increasingly, the emphasis in the life of the community of Christ is, how might we discern what God is calling this movement together into a future be? And that movement increasingly has the diversity that I think is very significant and represents expressions of that authority, in which persons represented in the Council of Twelve that I reside include four women and two of the men who reside as members of the Council of Twelve. One is from Africa and one from South America, of nations of Bolivia and Zambia. It is that the church increasingly is discerning as an international community, and that the community Christ represents, in a way, an alternative form of leadership with forms of authority that probably would leave Joseph Smith aghast at what has become of us. And yet, I praise God that we have taken the raft that we have, because it has been a faithful representation of one of the streams of theological discourse and of historical possibility that has honored and given glory to God. Amen.
Mormonism teaches that any sacrifice is worthwhile for service to God and the LDS Church. Spencer W. Kimball's 1969 Miracle of Forgiveness instructed each homosexually inclined male just to forget his desires and, quote, force himself, unquote, to date the opposite sex and marry a woman in one of the sacred temples for time and eternity. In 1971, the church officially published his pamphlet, New Horizons for Homosexuals, later called A Letter to a Friend, which had a section titled Multiply and Replenish as a step in repenting from homosexual activities. In effect, such counsel has turned generations of females into therapeutic sex objects to redeem homosexually oriented males, whose priesthood service to the LDS Church is more important than the happiness of their wives on earth. Women are not expendable in Mormonism, but their personal fulfillment is less important than male achievement. Modern apostles and prophets are not unaware of or unfeeling about the unhappiness experienced by wives of gay men or by husbands of lesbians. Although LDS headquarters usually refuses to accept those labels for people, quote, struggling with same-gender attraction, unquote, to adopt the authorized phrase, prophets and apostles have recognized this as a very real tragedy in the marriages and divorces of believing Latter-day Saints. More than 20 years ago, President Gordon B. Hinckley announced in the Official Church magazine, quote, marriage should not be viewed as a therapeutic step to solve problems such as homosexual inclinations or behavior, unquote. Nonetheless, marriage and parenthood by homosexually inclined Mormons have remained the ultimate goals of every publication, every sermon, every counseling session, every reparative therapy technique offered by LDS leaders, by LDS social services, by Evergreen International, and by so-called former homosexuals like Aaron Eldridge, in such books as Born That Way, published by Desert Book in 1994, and unofficially endorsed by LDS headquarters ever since. She discussed the prospect of marriage in her chapter on repentance, thus making a man
into a therapeutic sex object on her own road to redemption. Correspondingly, those same LDS outlets counsel against divorce by the unhappily married spouses of men and women with same-gender attraction. Yet such unhappiness is the direct result of making heterosexual marriage the achievable goal for people like Aaron and like me. The blessings I received in fathering and raising 4 children to maturity were not worth the decades of unhappiness I brought into the life of their mother, even though I was sexually faithful to her. Husbands like me can father children we love, but the marital tensions in a gay-straight marriage also hurt our children. There are hundreds of members in an organization for gay Mormon fathers, and I think every one of them would agree with me on both counts. However, the LDS Church has no monopoly on the kinds of pressure, contradictions, and sadness experienced by homosexually oriented Mormons. Over the years, I've found remarkable similarity in the youthful experiences of same-gender-oriented Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Shintoists, and members of other religious communities. If you think it's easier for young gays and lesbians raised by atheists, just ask a few. Throughout the world, there are subcultures that currently accept sexual diversity in their children, but these are very few by comparison. About 90% of human males share the same basic feelings about sexual attraction, and about 98% of human females share the same basic feelings about sexual attraction. They cannot even comprehend the question, quote, "When did you decide to be attracted to the opposite sex?" unquote. This makes it extremely difficult for them and for you, 90% of you or so, whether parents, friends, or religious leaders, to understand the other kinds of sexuality that occur just as naturally and often just as early within a very small percentage of humanity. I hope it is not asking too much of this vast majority of humans, for them and for you, to acknowledge that it's a living hell to be different in such circumstances. Most of us who are different in sexual orientation and desires have been willing to do anything to avoid confrontations with the heterosexual other. We don't need your repressiveness or any institution's repressiveness to force us to try to fit in. But our quandary is how to live a lie and still be happy, especially when our social acceptance causes pain to a spouse we love and to the children we produce in a gay-straight marriage. Eventually, many of us decide to live honestly as gays and lesbians rather than to live dishonestly as the sexually repressed people you, the 90% of you, most want us to be. For most, or for some rather, that means never getting married and choosing to live celibate. For others, it means remaining single and sexually active with those we find desirable. For some, it means cheating on spouses with furtive encounters of the same gender. For many, it means a lifelong marriage of love mingled with sexual frustration for both spouses. For others, it means divorce, whether we have been homosexually celibate or homosexually unfaithful to spouses. And so what can the institution, an institution like the LDS Church, do to aid those who are struggling with same-gender attractions, while the Church still maintains its core values? First, acknowledge officially that this struggle is not a choice. It arises spontaneously in a small minority of humans from a combination of genes, hormones, and environmental influences that are fixed before the age of 8. The age when each homosexually oriented child is innocent by LDS revelation. Second, LDS leaders should frequently urge those with this struggle to choose life on earth, not suicide. Third, frequently urge parents not to reject or kick out of the house their children who are struggling with same-gender attractions. Fourth, frequently urge parents not to reject their children who have decided to act upon those attractions. While maintaining a not-in-our-house rule, few parents of heterosexually active teenagers kick them out. Fifth, LDS leaders should frequently encourage all parents to be long-suffering, emotionally available, verbally kind, and nonviolent with their sexually active teenagers, so as not to force these vulnerable kids onto the streets as abandoned children or as runaways. Are these things too much to ask of the compassionate men who are prophets, seers, and revelators of the LDS Church? I hope not, because none of the above recommendations violate any commandment or revelation of God. Next is the more difficult question of altering LDS policies, whether traditional or recent, formal or informal. At the most fundamental level, I recommend changes which are absolutely consistent with all the commandments and revelations of God. First, change the general handbook of instructions to specify that there should be no punishments nor sanctions of any kind against Latter-day Saints who were struggling with same-gender attractions without having engaged in sex acts. There should be no restrictions on church service, including full-time missions, for simply being seriously tempted. Second, the general handbook should specify that the consequences of same-sex intimacy should be no more severe or long-lasting than the consequences for opposite-sex intimacy among the unmarried. Third, the general handbook should specify that just as there are no penalties for male-female kissing by the unmarried, there should be no penalties for same-gender kissing in public or in private. Fourth, the general handbook should specify that physically attacking persons suspected of being bisexual, homosexual, lesbian, or transgender is as serious a transgression as physically attacking anyone else, including battered spouses and abused children. Fifth, at least once during each general conference, a speaker should restate the above changes during the first 10 years after they are added to the general handbook. Every one of them is completely consistent with the gospel, and I hope I am mistaken in thinking that they have not yet been added to the general handbook during the years since I last read it. Now as to marriage. First, despite President Hinckley's emphatic statement in 1987, and despite the dangers of unhappy spouses and of children living with divorce of a gay-straight marriage, most LDS leaders and members believe that it would violate God's will if they do not encourage every homosexually inclined person to enter heterosexual marriage. Rather than a change in church policy, I ask all Mormons two questions. Would you advise your daughter or your granddaughter to marry a homosexually oriented man? Would you advise your son or your grandson to marry a homosexually oriented woman? If you cannot answer yes to both questions, then you should not counsel Mormons in general to do so. Make this your personal decision and leave the rest to God and his revelations to each individual struggling with same gender attractions. Second is the question of civil unions or legal marriage for persons of the same gender or same sex. I ask all LDS leaders and members with Pioneer Utah ancestry to remember that the plural marriages of their Mormon ancestors had no detrimental effects on, quote, the institution of marriage, or on traditional marriage in Boston, or anywhere else during the 19th century. The same is equally true for the legalized same-sex marriages now being performed and lived in New England, in Canada, and in much of Northern Europe. Historically and to the present, the unusual marriages of a very small minority have not damaged the traditional marriages of the vast majority. Let civil proceedings occur in the land of the free without interference by religious groups. After the legalization of same-sex marriage, religious officials can still decline to perform those marriages. just as Southern Baptist ministers were not required to perform interracial marriages after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Loving v. Virginia. Ministers have the privilege to perform civil marriage, not the obligation to do so, even after being licensed with that authority. A licensed minister can decline to perform any marriage, as an attorney and former judge, Apostle Dallin H. Oakes, knows this to be true. Virtually every neighborhood already has residents who are cohabiting without marriage, and these fornicators don't diminish the stability of your marriage, nor its importance. Letting queers like me legally marry another queer won't damage your marriages either. Please don't continue to use the LDS Church's money and organizational skills in political campaigns to deny civil rights and protections to homosexually oriented people. With regard to marital rights and privileges, we are now the least of God's children in America. Remember the words of Jesus, quote, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto the one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. And inasmuch as ye did it not unto one of the least of these, ye did it not unto me." Unquote. Thank you.
This is a tough group to follow. The one shining part of this evening for me is something I never thought would ever happen for me at a Sunstone Symposium. I have this evening been able to share the pulpit with an apostle. Go to Missouri, but nonetheless. I come at this perspective from a more studied angle, but at the same time also one of deep personal longings and motivation that has over the years propelled me to address questions related to community organizations and the impact of the ways in which we work with and live with one another. I didn't realize it at the time, but early on in my life, after I had finished up my undergraduate studies, I had one of these serendipitous moments that led to a brief career as a commissioned officer in the United States Marine Corps. If you think autocratic hierarchical command and control here in Salt Lake City is something, yeah, you ain't seen nothing yet. That for me is, you know, one of those experiences when you look back on your life, you can look at and say, okay, now I understand what that was about. I can help process it and make sense of it. Of course, that just might be cognitive dissonance trying to keep me from going schizophrenic, but be that as it may, this was a tremendous contrast effect. And as we know from the Book of Mormon, there must needs be an opposition in all things. This is not just something lightly for our experience. There must be opposition. Otherwise, everything would be a compound in one. Now, that setup is by way of taking a few minutes, since I'm the academic on the on the panel. I'm going to take a few minutes and walk us through some PowerPoints. Not in terms of training, but in terms of my day job right now, anyhow. So, with that in mind, I'm going to walk through a couple of PowerPoint slides from the area of organizational behavior. And although I was trained as an organizational psychologist,
I work at the business school at Weber State, the university, and we call it organizational behavior and get paid twice as much for it over there. So we've taken a few lessons from our marketing colleagues, but if any of you know of any organizations that are misbehaving, give me a call or chat me up afterwards. We can sort things out. This is just a short typology that I hope will provide a framework here just in the few minutes that I'm going to take. This is a typology that tries to map out the way in which we have bases of power to influence others. Now, starting at the bottom of the list here on the left, of course, is coercive power. And we all know what that is. That's the attempt to influence and compel others through punishment, through threats, through intimidation, through bullying, and so on. Reward power is the carrot side of the equation, whereas coercion is the stick. The reward power is the use of carrots, incentives, and things of that nature. Now, an important thing here when we're talking about this reward is that most of the time it's used in an external way. That is, you do what I want, and I'll trade or exchange for something that you want. In the middle is what we tend to rely on most as human beings, at least in our modern Western cultures, and this is legitimate power. Legitimate power is the power that resides in the position that you hold in an organization. It's often referred to as authority power. It's power that you have to tell somebody to do because of the stripes on your sleeve or because of the title on your business card. Or because you have been given some institutional authority formally by the organization. So you're a manager, a leader, an executive, whatever it might be. Next, you have expert power, which is the ability that we have to influence and motivate others through the use of knowledge, expertise, skills, or abilities that that we hold. And last but not least, the one at the top of this list is often referred to as referent power, sometimes referred to as charisma power. This is the ability that we have to influence and motivate others through the regard that we have, through the fact that they feel honored and respected and honor and respect us. So it's the ability to get people to agree to requests out of respect and positive regard. Now, on the right-hand side of this chart, I've got what I call the motivation continuum. This is the way in which people can respond to the exercise of power and authority to try to influence others. The bottom is resistance. And, of course, you could maybe even say this is negative motivation because this is when people dig in their heels. Sometimes that resistance is open and active where they fight back. Of course, if you fight back with an autocrat who's using coercion, usually the end result is a scorched earth, but that is active resistance. Many of us would prefer, instead of scorched earth, just passive resistance, nodding, you know, but and saying, yes, I will, but in reality, when the autocrat is gone, you simply go and do what you're going to do anyway, right? In the middle is what I would refer to as compliance. This is the notion that you will agree to do what's been requested or demanded of you because you are going to comply, but it's at the bare minimum. In other words, it's the letter of the law. I'll do what I'm required to do, but nothing more. The response at the top of the continuum would be the idea of commitment. And as the name suggests, or the word suggests, you know, commitment is what happens when we feel intrinsically passionate about what we have been asked to do, or what others have influenced or exercised power and authority over us to do. When we respond with commitment and passion, this is intrinsic motivation. Yes, we're following a request, but in fact, it's something of internal desire that moves us beyond just the legitimate request. Now, the point with the previous slide with the left-hand side of the equation, the right-hand side of the equation, is that they're directly related.
And that as frustrating and maddening as human behavior can be, it's really quite simple to predict the kinds of reactions you will get from others on the motivation continuum if you look at the bases of power that are being used to influence others. Coercion invariably prompts resistance, either active or passive. Reward, when it is used in a way as an external motivator, that is a transactional reward, do what I want and I'll give you the carrot as opposed to the stick. At first, that can often be viewed as a positive and desirable thing, but over time, what human beings will do is they will begin to resent the situation that you've created and feel like they are being manipulated and coerced into giving you what you want in order to get the reward or the desire. So coercion and reward are two sides of the same coin when it comes to the exercise of power. And it's just a little switch in the minds and the heads and the psychology of the person on whom this power is being exercised that turns what we think is a wonderful external reward system into coercion. Legitimate authority is as long as people in positions of power and authority in organizations where we are members give us legitimate and lawful orders. They don't ask us to do things that are illegal or unethical. Most of us recognize that that's the price we pay for being subordinate in an organization. That there are people in the hierarchy above us and they get to call the shots. Expert power moves us more towards, to the degree that expertise is respected and honored in people who make a request, we're more inclined to respond positively. The referent power at the top of the list is the kind of power that transcends and goes far beyond legitimate authority. And this is really the key that I want to emphasize, because if you look at the power bases on the left, overwhelmingly most of us in organizations and hierarchies are concerned primarily and at a very basic level about who's in charge. Who gets to tell us what to do? Who gets to play the trump card, right? I've got more stripes than you, and I've got a higher position, a higher status, therefore I have the right within our organizational structure to issue orders or to demand compliance. When we begin to motivate and try to exercise power and influence over people that transcends the position, it moves into true and genuine leadership. But ironically, it's the kind of leadership that we see at the heart of the disciple or servant leadership that's laid out for us in the New Testament. And I would suggest that when you put all these things together, you can actually, if you would, lay out an organization on the couch, like a psychologist might with an individual, and get into that individual organization's personality, which we would call culture. Culture is the kind of thing that we all see and recognize around us, kind of one of those known when I see it sorts of things. But if you take a look at this figure, this is my crude attempt at drawing an iceberg using a PowerPoint. but you'll see that the iceberg is the culture. And with the iceberg, 15-20% of the iceberg is above surface. Most of the iceberg is beneath the surface. You don't see it. And those core cultural norms, values, beliefs, and assumptions are so deeply embedded that for many of us they're subconscious. When you move above that and you see the artifacts of culture, whether it's the culture of an organization, a business, a church, a nation, an ethnic group, a subculture group, the things that you see at the top, the stories, the rules, the policies, the procedures, the way language is used, who gets to initiate conversations and addresses and responds in different ways, architecture, physical structures, the rituals and ceremonies, those are all manifestations of the deeper underlying values. Now here's the thing to keep in mind when we talk about the use and exercise of power and authority within the institutional church and the way in which it gets manifested as the culture, and that is, culture is the one phenomenon of organizational life that I would argue is subject to the law of gravity. That is, it flows from the top down. Because the things at the top, the stories we tell about our heroes, the rules, the policies, the procedures, who decides the way language is used, who gets to call whom by a first name or has to use a formal title, those things are all set in place formally and institutionally by the leadership, right? Those who are in formal positions of authority to make those organizational laws, the rules and policies and procedures. So when Mike Quinn, for example, talks about the need to rewrite the Church Handbook of Instruction, that's precisely what we're talking about. Rewriting the rules and the policies and procedures in a way that reflect the underlying values and beliefs and assumptions that we would like to have. Now, the challenge is how to respond when you're in an institutional framework where the rules and policies and the artifacts and whatnot are inconsistent with the core values and beliefs and assumptions that you have. Well, one of the ways that you have to do that is you have to make sure that you do not use the overbearing, coercive, autocratic kinds of power ploys against those who have used those very things against you. So that doesn't leave you much other than the referent and the expert power. And that's a hard thing to do. But the thing to keep in mind as we start to look at the kinds of issues and demands that are incumbent upon those who would strive to be disciples of the master that we read about over 2,000 years ago, that kind of leadership and exercise of power was a radical departure from the norms of his day. You know, the way in which culture and leadership and power was exercised in that Mediterranean world 2,000 years ago, it was the hallmark of oppression, of hierarchy, of intimidation, in order to extract and demand compliance of those over whom that exercise and authority was utilized. So many people, I will see, respond by moving away from these consequences of autocratic, hierarchical command and control that creates these coercive environments, and will instead walk away from the power. But the paradox, if you will, about servant leadership is that you don't walk away from power. But what tools and bases of power that you have at your disposal, you use not to enrich and to build up and enlarge yourself, but to serve and build up others, to empower the powerless, and do all the kinds of things that the world tells you are foolish if you have a position of power, authority, or money. And at the end of the day, one of the acid tests, if you will, of the true values of not only individuals, but the core values of any organization and the leadership of that organization, I would submit to you, is to just follow the money. See where they spend their money, where the budgets go, and so forth, and you will get it right 9 times out of 10 when you're trying to figure out what the real core values are of the movers and shakers, the decision makers who make those decisions about where those resources will be spent. But again, as we respond, even though we may not have the institutional power and authority that we would like to effect these changes, it's important that we raise our voices. It's important that we communicate with conviction our values, our beliefs, our aspirations, but that it be done with honor and respect. That's a very difficult thing when you feel like you are on the short end of the equation. To do otherwise would leave us in a predicament that I think is outlined actually in the hymn that we sung to begin the session tonight. And in fact, I hadn't really thought to end this way, but I think it would be a good a way to conclude. As we were singing the hymn, I was caught up by the last two stanzas of the second line. So if you have your hymn with me, you can follow along. I mean, it is very tempting if you feel like you are on the margin of your community. If you have been one of the displaced, one of the marginalized, one of the least, and things just continue to go from bad to worse. It's very understandable to want to fight back, if not all but go to war with the power structures to bring about change. But the last two verses, if you pick up with me and just follow along at verse 2. Hear the cries of war fall silent. Feel our love glow like the sun. When we all serve one another, then our heaven is begun. Thank you.
Thank you. That was wonderful. On behalf of the audience, I want to thank all of you for the time you spent, and most of all, for bearing your souls. We have about 10 minutes for Q&A, so let's start the lineup here, and then we'll close after that. So first, the Q&A.
This isn't really a question, but Darius, you'll recall I was in that same student ward that you talked about, and I really hope like heck I wasn't the one who was passing a sacrament that day. I don't think I was. What you didn't say was that in kind of slightly evading the strictures of the church at the time, Darius was made the Sunday school president. And there were a number of us who wanted to promote him to the elders' quorum president and couldn't pull it off. So, believe it or not, whether you knew it or not, you really had some support, but maybe you didn't know it at the time.
Thank you. I'm glad I didn't get that call as elders' quorum president.
Since we're just adding little footnotes here, a wonderful panel. But I wanted to not really correct Michael, but mention something they left out. When you cited the jurisdictions that accepted same-sex marriage, you left out the great state of Iowa.
Oh.
And of all the states, anyway, that did by court decision, the state of Iowa was the only one that had a unanimous decision of the Supreme Court. And we also gave the nation to Barack Obama.
Evening, expecting to hear something about who exercises power and authority in the LDS Church, what matters about who's inside and who's outside the current power structure. Our panel will explore personal spirit and LDS implication. With some of that, we didn't hear anything about who exercises power in the LDS Church. Maybe Mike alluded to it. From the community of Christ, we heard something about some bottom-up influences on decision and authority. I don't see any of that in the LDS Church. Maybe you can help me see whether there might be. We've had a conversation about what it means to sustain people in church. But I guess I'd like to just hear some comments about the, is this is this the way it should be, the way it's done now in the church? Not.
I can
kind of gutsy.
Put a few comments on that.
Jane, it's okay with you, I know, Jane. You said it's okay the way it is now. But
I said it was okay. No. I did not say it was okay.
Is this the way it should be?
No, it's not the way it should be. I hope I didn't give the impression that I think it's okay. I hope I gave the impression that I am not currently struggling as much as I used to struggle with this issue.
Well, I interpret that as being it's okay as far as you're concerned.
Okay. You're a glass half full kind of guy. That's wonderful. You know, I think that Darius said it best when he said, "Who has power? Not me." That's how I feel much of the time. And when my friend Chris and I were co-writing Mormonism for Dummies, we went through the entire table of contents and we decided, you know, you'd write this part, I'd write this part, and we'd switch off. And I realized that I had been given the section on priesthood, what happens in a priesthood meeting, what's accomplished there. And so I called Chris and I said, you know, I have no idea. You all could be smoking crack for all of them. And so we switched. But, you know, there is something very disturbing when a fully invested and involved active member of an institution has no idea what's going on across the hall. So it was funny, but it's not funny.
I'm not sure you have the dilemma I see.
And first, her comment is correct. I don't feel that I have power. And again, all of us, whomever we are, serve at the pleasure of the presiding authority, whether local or general. I have a unique position in that I can have the ear of certain of the senior general authorities. And I'm very judicious in my application of that opportunity. But what comes from that is, it's much as in the scriptures, casting your bread upon the water. You go in, you present the issue, you make your case, you stand up, thank the individual, shake hands, and you're gone. And you don't know what's going to come of it, if anything, and if it does, when. So again, it does not feel as though, even with access, that you have power. All you have is an audience. And it's a pleasant audience, but you don't know that anything is going to come of it.
Well, having an audience is a beginning. It's better than what Mike has. Mike's audience is here, amazingly. And he's made some, I think, very constructive, specific suggestions that will get no hearing, I believe. And they should.
I would say I'd back up and ask again, what kind of power are you talking about? Are you talking about power which we commonly use as synonymous with the legitimate authority, that is, people who hold a position? Well, in that case, institutionally, the answer is very clear. But when it comes to the other kinds of bases of power and influence, well, you know, what happens when you have so-called, you know, intellectuals? And I hope my comment didn't put anybody off when I said I was the only academic. I meant in terms of just my day job, because this panel is full of some, you know, extraordinarily expert, knowledgeable people in things of doctrine and history that are a threat to the power brokers who have authority simply because of the office that they hold. And so, you know, we can see in our own history as a community what kind of responses to that expert power that has been exercised over the years when that expertise is brought to the table, very legitimate, very thoughtful, very responsible questions that were not welcomed by the institutional power brokers within the hierarchy. So especially when you have an organizational culture like we do, you know, here in the Salt Lake Church that has a very, very clearly defined set of cultural artifacts, the policies, the procedures, the rules, who's in charge, who's not in charge, the reporting authority, and all the rest. To try to exercise power and influence outside of the formal channels in a very institutionalized authority structure is a very risky proposition. And so the answer is that we all have different bases of power that we can use, but there's really only one institutional power base. And even though Darius might say he really has no power, you know, he has inherent in his calling, in his priesthood, the right to be a ward clerk, the right to be a Sunday school president, the right to be a bishop, the right to be a state president. Whereas, you know, more than half of us in here simply do not have access to that institutional power except through these other sorts of informal means and channels, through the ones that we talked about.
The direction of power is always down.
Only if your view of power is that it's the institutional authority, then it's people above you in the hierarchy who exercise the kind of power that you're talking about.
Yeah.
When it comes to the other kind, like referent power and expert power, that can flow not only from the bottom up, but laterally as well. And at the end, is really the only healthy kind of power that can be exercised if the goal is to create a vibrant, collaborative community of peers and equals, rather than one that reinforces subordinate relationships.
Unfortunately, it's exercise precious too.
This is kind of directed to both Mike and Janet. I was very encouraged and heartened by Janet's confident assertion that there will come a time when women will have the priesthood. And I was also impressed with Mike's, what I guess I would call, modest proposals that really were modest in the sense that they don't violate any current doctrine. And I wonder whether either or both of you are as confident that sometime in the future, and maybe not even as distant as 200 years, there will be a time when gay marriages or gay civil unions will be accepted by the church and will not be grounds for excommunication.
Mm. Do you want to start?
I'm not holding my breath. And I wouldn't ask my children or my grandchildren to hold their breaths. But I do think that these modest proposals that I made today are attainable, should be attainable, even within my lifetime.
I'm far from an expert on that issue. I think that, at least in our lifetimes, probably the best that we can hope for is a retreat and finally just leaving well enough alone. This is not something that I talked about in my remarks tonight, but, you know, it's been a very painful year to be a Latter-day Saint. And I think that those of us who feel strongly that the church... those of us who disagree with the church on this issue of same-sex marriage and perhaps even more immediately the role of a religious organization in lobbying in a political cause, I think it's going to be a painful time for some time to come.
My question is for Jan. A lot of the things that you said, I actually find reflected in my own feelings about, well, things are not quite fair, but well, you know, I have a lot of things going on, and I don't really feel that oppressed, and yet, I look at that, and I see that reflected in many women that are around my age, that are, you know, like 30s, and approaching 40, and we... And a lot of them say, like, well, I just read, you know, Women in Authority, and I don't know why everybody's so upset about Mother in Heaven, and I'm not that worried, and, you know, and it's not sort of the thing that you would expect maybe from younger women in the church as opposed to women that are, you know, maybe in their 60s, but I wonder if we sort of are more comfortable because of the battles that have been fought before us, mm-hmm. and we are also more able to find a life outside of the church. So if we're not getting what we want in the church, oh well, tomorrow's Monday and I'll just go to church, I'll go to work where I'm the boss, mm-hmm. and it's not that big a deal if today he's the boss and tomorrow I'm the boss, and it's just not that big a deal as it was to the generation before us who couldn't go to work on Monday and who was home on Monday with kids and, you know, no opportunities and a mind that really needed to be working on a PhD and wasn't. So I wonder if you have any comments on
that. I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm conscious of the fact that we don't have a whole lot of time, but, you know, this generational issue that you have spoken to, I see illustrated very clearly in my own family. My mother was an ERA activist. By the way, I guess I got across the point that I didn't grow up Mormon. My mom was agnostic. My father was atheist. My mom was an ERA activist in the state of Illinois, and when the ERA was defeated, it was a tremendous blow for her. When I joined the church, that was another tremendous blow for her because that was her memory. She had sacrificed so much to try to attain equality for women and to have me go and join some wacky cult that oppresses women. You know, that was hard. She has a very different perspective now. But I think when you talk about some of the issues that may not be as immediate for our generation or who people in our 30s and maybe approaching 40 who are a little more resolved, it's because we've stood on the shoulders of giants. And I am always mindful of that. You know, many of the people in this room were those giants. I was baptized in September of 1993. And, of course, that was a very difficult and resonant time for many people in this room, with people being excommunicated precisely because of some of these issues. And I knew as I went into the water that there might not be a place for me in this church. So far, I think there has been, and I hope that that will continue. But it is because of the sacrifices of the people who went before, and I hope we always remember that.
A quick question for Darius. Is it true that you have held one priesthood office, namely that of high priest?
As opposed to?
Well, for us white boys, you know, we're deacons, teachers, priests,
no,
elders, 70s.
I understand the question, no. I started out in the Aaronic priesthood and moved to the Melchizedek and then I'm a priest.
So, okay.
But as an adult, they moved me along fairly quickly. So Tuesday I was...
Okay. And then I have a question for Dale. How raucous do the parliamentary sessions in your general conferences become with all the parliamentary debates?
Depends on the issue.
Talk about it.
Actually, we are far more civil than folks might want to suggest. One of the things that you will find in the community of Christ is an openness to engage one another with candor. Perhaps it was being left behind that was a part of it. One person suggested to me that the reason many of us drink coffee is that we were on coffee break during the time when the wagon trains were. But anyway, so it's a long tradition. But there is a certain kind of independence. Perhaps having headquarters in independence helps to spark that. To be very, very frank, the whole issue of same-sex marriage is a very hot issue for us currently. I don't know what the resolution of this is going to be. Bill is probably an expert on some of the factors, and I think Bill and I would both scratch our heads and wonder what the outcome. It could be very divisive. If we think that the ordination of women was a very divisive issue that was, it was like an earthquake hit. We lost close to 25% of our membership over that issue, to be candid. However, we're a better denomination for it, having gone through that. I think that as a community, we understand that numbers are not the issue, that faithfulness to what we understand to be God's revelatory will in and through us is the issue. How do we become and continue to be a faithful community? And I think that's often at the heart of our dialogue and of our conversation and of our intense debate, in which even the president of the church may be challenged to say, Brother Vesey, I disagree with you.
I wrote one of those letters just last month.
And for our style of who we've become, and again, I just reflect, that's in the lineage for us of Joseph Smith III, who is very different than his father in many ways. And I think that's had a stamp on us. And for us, our authority, I guess, would arise not because somebody tells us what it is in terms of rules and policies, but what we discover together as a community. And I think that's probably why we are getting so comfortable with our name and yet so pricked by the name to live up to it, of Community of Christ, because I think it does describe us and call us constantly forward to be what we claim that we are.
Thanks. I think that's a great note to close on. Once again, I want to thank our Dean Watson and Alan Eastman for their spirited music. We'll close by singing "The Lord is My Shepherd." Following the closing song, the benediction will be given by Levina Fielding Anderson.
Greater kindness, and we ask this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.